Hey, y'all. Did you miss me?
Yes.
Yeah, right. There's I missed you. I'm currently on Vancouver time. For those of you that are not globally aware, that is 6 a.m. So I wish I could lecture to you from bed, but I can't. Somebody left us sitting around, so expelliarmus. Doesn't work. So there is, let's see, if you look at the class website, if you look at the calendar, if you look at the way things play out, we have about 5 more actual lectures. So one of the things you have to look forward to is you have to listen to me for less than 10 more hours, thank heavens. On the other hand, part of that also is another midterm. Third midterm is coming up next Monday. I'll talk a little bit about that and getting ready for it. I will give you tools to succeed. We have covered a lot of stuff, and so instead of one cheat sheet that's up on the screens, I'll be printing out cheat sheets, and then you can grab them with your test, or they'll be attached to your test. Because there's lots of formulas, right? I mean, even just rotational motion is a page of formulas. As we've seen before. So happy birthday to one of your classmates who shares a birthday with Condoleezza Rice, Yarni. Today is obviously a fun name day, right? Buckwheat Zydeco's birthday is today. Who here knows Buckwheat Zydeco? Who here is a fan of, like, Louisiana Cajun accordion music? That's Buckwheat Zydeco.
Not some sort of fun tune.
No. What is, who here knows Boutros Ghali? Former UN Leo. There's who here knows Aaron Copland? What have you people been doing with your lives? There you go. Okay, the band geeks, of course, know Aaron Copland. So Aaron Copland is one of the great, fabulous, traditional American composers of the early 20th century. And Claude, who here knows Monet? I mean, come on. At least I got to get one, right? So it's Happy National Spicy Guacamole Day. Where do they get this? Anyway.
As a bureau of people in the government.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think there are going to be bureaus of people in the government that are going to be real interesting over the next 4 years. But we won't go into that because we are apolitical when you come into physics. Except you must obey the laws of physics. Ha! And Expelliarmus. So since I was on a different time zone and I was kind of whacked out and overworked last week, I decided not to overwork all of y'all and pass that on to you. So last week's homework in that email that I sent out kind of got waylaid. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up homework later on this afternoon, I promise, I'm back, that will be due next Monday, and you can also use it as prep for the exam. So this homework covers items that will be on the exam on the midterm, and I list those things there, right? So all of the rotational kinematics stuff is part of the exam. It's all a big exam, right? All of the rotational equilibrium stuff, Lancelot climbing the ladder problem. The things that Dr. Terzic Balsha covered last Monday, started covering, and I'll finish up today. And then fluid mechanics, which we're doing today and Wednesday, and then we'll do review. It's a lot of stuff, but by the time you get into this part of the first year physics program, it starts to feel a little bit like a laundry list. Like, oh, we got to touch this base. Oh, we got to talk about this. Oh, we got to talk about that. It's harder and harder to construct a narrative. If there's anything I can convey to y'all, particularly as a singular audience here, is that the narrative here is all stuff that you as engineering students or physics students or chemistry, that you will see again, particularly the engineers. Right? Stress, strain, equilibrium stuff. Mechies, civvies, your houses fall down, your engines blow up, whatever it is. You know, bad things happen if you don't pay attention to these details. Fluid mechanics, all the pneumatics, all of the hydraulics, all of those pieces, bad things happen if your machines don't work because of those tools, right? So you are learning some of the underlying principles of things that build the foundation, hopefully a solid foundation, for your future endeavors as engineers, physicists, etc. Yes.
Now that we are getting towards the end of the year, are we looking to actually get into thermodynamics?
No. Okay. Thermo is one area that I had to chop out at the end. Because thermo is, we'll kind of vaguely touch on thermo and some of the fluid static stuff. Okay. But thermo is an area where it's an entire course down the line. I wish I had more time to cover it. I wish I had more time to cover acoustics, which I love. Unfortunately, we just don't have enough time. And it's more important to cover the things that we're covering because it's got a broader range of applicability for everybody. Because the things that we're doing after this, before the exam, is all simple harmonic motion, and that's deeply connected to everything. I'm going to keep this stick. I like this stick because I'm waving it around like a conductor. So, like I said, I'll prepare a cheat sheet with material tables of material constants, moments of inertia, all of that stuff. Somebody asked if I'm going to post a sample midterm. I'll post something like it. Okay? Something else for you to practice on besides the homework. That's extra, if you like. It will be consistent with the difficulty level that I expect the exam to have. So remember this, for example, this is already going to be one of these sheets on your cheat sheet. And you look at this and go, oh my God, where do I start when you approach a rotational kinematics problem? Yep. It's all right. Start on the right, if it's rotational kinematics at least. But we've been here before. Are there any questions about the exam, about the prep for the exam, about getting ready for the next few weeks? There was one other question, and just as a reminder for those of you that don't remember the syllabus and grading, remember one midterm is dropped in your final grade, and out of the 30% that's homework, about 5 to 10% is that homework notebook that you're going to turn in a couple weeks, right? That should include this upcoming homework. So far, so good. I actually got a crowd today. I heard it was kind of quiet last week, so which is great. So let's have a quick review. It won't be so quick, but it's very relevant, right? Stress. End of the semester, getting close to the holidays. Wrong stress. So tensile stress, right? Pulling, compressive stress also is the same thing. One-dimensional attempts to stretch or compress some sort of a solid or a liquid. Generally, you don't talk about stresses when you're talking about gases. Gases end up being a lot of thermodynamics and chemistry and PV equals NRT, otherwise known as Pivner. But for you engineers, stresses are very, very important because when you do construction, compressive stress is the majority stress that you deal with in your buildings of things, while tensile stress is the majority thing that you deal with building, like a suspension bridge, right, where all of those guide wires and guy lines are under tension instead. Bulk stress, pressure on something from all sides, put something in a container, squish it down like your little brother. He's not very compressible. Okay? But as you push something down, how can you compress it? Later on, we'll find out that a lot of liquids, a lot of solids are close to incompressible. You're not going to change the volume much. Water is a classic example. And then there's shear stress, right? How do you, if you push something against, try and break it apart, okay, Good, I can't break my wand, which is good. Or if you try and clip something in half, that's otherwise known as shear. And many, many materials, in particular things like wood, have very, very good shear bulk moduli, have very good resistance to shear, because they have all of those fibers running along the grain, right? So this is a review of stuff that you covered last week with Dr. Balsha, right? And all of these things, they were all introduced to you on separate slides, but they're all pretty common, right? Stress or strain is a force per unit area somehow. Whether it's a force per unit area that you're trying to compress something with or shear something with, or a force per unit area that you're trying to compactify something with, it's still the same thing. And in a little bit, when we get into fluids and gases, force per unit area, if you took a chemistry course in high school or a physics course in high school, force per unit area is the definition of pressure. And there's a special unit called Pascals just for force per unit area. And then how something changes, well, okay, under these stresses is called a strain. And there's bulk strain, volumetric strain, tensile strain, right? Strains are proportional changes to an item. All strains are unitless, at least in physics. And I think as you go in your engineering careers, you'll even have special symbols for different kinds of strains. So a bulk compression is a relative change in volume, while a linear compression is a bulk change or, a ratio change of length. And shear goes the same way. That shear is more like an angle and how much angle something deflects. The one common thing, get it in your head, stresses are pressures. Strains are unitless ratios of changes of something, whether it's a volume or a length, a dimension. And moduli are the ratios between those. And a modulus, whether it's a Young's modulus for linear tension or compression, or a bulk modulus for packing something down like your little brother in the box, right? A modulus is the ratio of those. So a modulus is a ratio of a pressure to whatever change it causes. Not a force for whatever change it causes, it's force per unit area for whatever change it causes. And the moduli, all of units, therefore, right, of pressure, of examples. A modulus, like it says on the slide, right, all of these things, once you have folded out all the details of the object, the area or the length and all of that stuff, you measure this for something made of iron that's small or something made of iron that's big, it turns out to be the same modulus, right? That's a material property. It's not a property of the object's color or size or whatever it is. It's just whatever material the thing is made of. So these are great. You can then build a table and look them up and do engineering with them. And these all also only apply, right, that ratio there. The modulus is the ratio of the change, the pressure over the change, the stress over the strain. That assumes that it's a linear relationship between the stress and the strain and that the modulus is something constant. That only applies within a certain limit. You can take something and stretch it to the point where all of this stuff breaks down just like your material breaks down. So for now, at least, though, you're engineers. You want your buildings to stay up. You want your wings to stay on Dr. Todd's plane, I hope. Maybe not. You want your bridges to stay up. So you want these materials to stretch elastically and not beyond them. So here's a table of Young's moduli, table of bulk moduli. They're pretty close for most things, okay? And in fact, I even added a little column on this table out of the textbook, which is the ratio of the bulk moduli to the Young's modulus, just to see, oh, okay, you know. Yeah, it's on the order of one for the most part for a lot of things, a half to 1.5 to even 2 for lead, right? So lead is a larger ratio of this stuff, means that stress doesn't change the things much. Lead is actually kind of compressible, more compressible than iron is, for instance. And then rubber. Rubber has an amazingly huge difference between the Young's modulus and bulk modulus, right? So that ratio at least means that stress doesn't change the volume much. In fact, this is exactly why you make things like O-rings out of rubber. You stress it one way, it pushes out the other side and seals the gaps or seals the edges. You want something with a large B over Y ratio if you're doing something like squishing it and having it squish out the other sides to make a seal. So Young's modulus to bulk modulus is a handy ratio to have floating around. But it's even though all of these numbers look very, very similar, I mean, it's amazing the range that you get, right, in the ratio of bulk modulus to Young's modulus. It's, you know, a factor of 250 or something like that, just on a small table here. So here's a problem from the book. I think it's even a problem. It might be a problem from the homework, in which case, yay, you get the benefit of coming to class and reading the slides. So apply these ideas, right? Apply the idea that stress over strain is a modulus, is a material property, and use that to figure out, I got a post and I'm putting something big and heavy on it, and how does the post compress? Okay, so I look up a few things. I look up linear compression, so not linear compression, I have to look up the Young's modulus. The Young's modulus is the force per unit area, the stress over the strain, the proportional change in compression of that post. So I look up the Young's modulus of steel, and it's some big number, right? 10 to the 11th pascals. Remember, Young's modulus is defined as stress over strain. The area of the post. If you're in doubt, just type it into Google. You have your computers, you have your cell phones during the exam. Don't immediately go, oh yeah, 25 centimeters is 0.025 meters. Oops. 25 centimeters is 1/4 of a meter. Square that and you get 0.625. Okay, 0.63 square meters. And the length of the post is 2.5 meters long. And so from all of that stuff, you can calculate what the stress is, what the strain is, and then what the proportional change in length of that load is. Okay? So 2.5 meters, right? How far does this thing compress when I stick that 8,000 kilograms on it, which seems like a lot? Well, thank heavens it's made out of solid steel because it compresses about 160 nanometers. I can measure that. Anybody know how I measure that? It ain't a caliper.
A microscope?
A microscope. How do I calibrate the microscope? Generally, the way you measure very, very small distances like this is something called laser interferometry. And you can actually use a laser as your measuring stick and the wavelength of the laser as your measuring stick. And then you can actually measure something in units of wavelengths of the laser. And you can get down well below nanometers, down to atom sizes doing that. Nanoangstroms is pretty small. Nanoangstroms is tough.
I know. I think that's because it was a reference.
So any questions on, you know, this is a pretty straightforward, it's relatively plug and chug, as many of these problems are at this stage. Yeah. Oh, and I made a mistake here. Nobody pointed it out. 25 centimeters in diameter. Okay. So I thought it was a square post 25 centimeters on a side. So I actually need to take the radius and do pi r squared. I'll make a note to myself to fix that in the actual area wrong. Pi r squared. Right. So I calculated the area wrong when I was typing this up in my bleary haze on a plane. I apologize. I will fix those numbers.
It would be roughly 3/4 of what you got.
Yep, roughly-ish. So thank you for pointing that out. Look at that. Sleep deprivation actually does compromise your faculties and your faculty. So let's see. So where were we? So you saw some of this before, maybe barely, right? This is how complicated it gets for you real engineers to have to live in the real world. Physicists can assume, you know, a spherical horse of uniform density and Hooke's law applies forever, blah, blah, blah. But at some point, what happens is, you know, there are limits to all of these theories. You know there are limits to the idea that if I push on this thing infinitely hard or pull on this thing infinitely hard, it's going to do some things. It's either going to fracture or it's going to start stretching in ways that you don't expect, you know, wouldn't be predicted by just this behavior. This linear portion in here is perfectly fine, right? That stress, the forces I apply up to those limits, when I'm still in the elastic regime and I take the force away and the thing comes back to where it was, that's called Hooke's law. Yeah, and I wrote down, it's not really a law. It was written down as a law for materials 200 years ago, and it's a law only under certain conditions, just like Newton's laws are laws only in certain conditions. It should really say Hooke's really, really good approximation for small deformations in some types of materials, but it doesn't sound nearly as useful. Okay? It only applies for ideal springs for elastic deformations of materials. And when you get up to a certain point, what happens with some materials, this is something that it hits a limit and it starts stretching more, and then it turns and it assumes a plastic behavior where it really stretches quickly. You can see a small change in force is going to cause a large change in deformation. And also, when I relax the thing, it's not going to come back to where it was before. It's going to be permanently set or permanently deformed. And if I keep on pushing it, what I do is I hit some point where all of a sudden I don't need nearly as much force to separate the pieces because, my gosh, it started necking or it started fracturing and it hit a point where it just breaks apart. Right? So this type of curve, particularly you mechies and you civvies, you'll see it again. And you'll see it a lot. And this is a picture for something like a metal, in particular a ductile metal rather than a frangible metal or a fractious metal, something that'll just snap rather than start necking down and going. Okay? So how does this look like, you know, kind of more locally if I take a spring? So this is an example from some website I found of Hooke's law, right? And the spring at this center point is at rest. And I either compress it or I stretch it. Remember, F equals minus kx. Remember our spring force that we had earlier in the semester? The force was proportional to x, the elongation or compression of the spring. that was a statement of Hooke's law, a linear relationship between the two. I'll even write it down on here as a reminder. So, to elucidate in the slides as posted. And what this picture shows you is that, okay, within a certain region of elongation and compression, yeah, Hooke's law, that linear relationship applies. But at some point, and I didn't bring my slinky in and do this because I don't want to break my slinky. It's my slinky. Yeah, exactly. So, but at some point, you hit a point where you need more force to stretch the thing. And it starts fighting you. This curve, which was linear, starts taking off in there. And you can see you need more and more force to deform the object. The extra energy you're adding in isn't going to just elongating the object anymore, isn't going to stretching the lattice of the object. It's actually going to deforming the object. And the same goes for compression. You need more negative force to deform the object. So I put on everybody's tables, I put a couple of examples of Hooke's law, right? Okay. And this kind of stuff, it you can look at all the slides you want, but there's nothing that satisfies like a Snickers or like a rubber band, an example of something stretchy where you can pull it and you can feel that elastic limit start to occur. You can feel where it starts to get to the point where, oh, the force right around here really starts fighting me more than it took just to start stretching the thing. Right? That visceral feeling of Hooke's law was something like a slinky or something like, you know, a rubber band. And then you can stretch it more and stretch it more. And yes, you've got higher and higher forces to stretch it just a little bit. And then at some point, you're going to hit the fracture point, right? And I'm not going to do it. Go ahead and do it. Don't sue me, please. I didn't know where those rubber bands came from. But that visceral feeling, okay, of stretching an elastic, this is an example of that theory. Connect to it. The world around you is examples of everything we do. And the world around you is engineers. You're engineers because you inhabit a world that is designed. Like that original statement I had about Steve Jobs' quote. That great insight that the world, everything is designed. Well, okay, everything is designed. Apply what you know here and walk out the door and let it change the way you look at the world. And let you realize that all of these posts in here are under compressive forces. So this is as an old friend of mine who's Russian who used to teach a course and really annoy me, he'd flip his long hair and go up on the board and do something complicated in front of all the students and say, oh, it's so simple. Oh, it's so simple. And I'd be teaching with him and I would fall off my chair in the back because that's the last thing you say to a student. Right? It's not simple. I get it. I was in your place once. However, it is in the world around you. And these are... I'm a physicist. I'm one of those spherical horse with a uniform density kind of people. You're engineers. You're going to have to deal with the complications of the real world. And some of those complications include the idea that, as I take this, you could even almost observe it from here. Right? Right, there's the cross section. And then as I stretch it, the cross section goes down. Because the volume has to get spread out among that longer length, right? So the cross-section is bigger, cross-section is smaller. The cross-section changes. Well, was that included in all of our theory? No, stress was force per unit area. So as the area goes down for the same force, the stress goes up. So as I'm stretching it, my stress applied, if I'm applying a constant force, actually goes up. Okay, that starts to get a little complicated. If something starts getting past the elastic limit, the standard term for this is necking, where somewhere along the length of your rod that is being stretched, you're under tension. Yes, it's a technical term. It's also known as snogging in Britain. It will pin down, and that cross-sectional area, when it's reduced, then has a higher stress. It's no surprise that the way that these materials fail, when as soon as they start necking, you get into a positive feedback condition where then it produces higher stress because it's the same force over a smaller cross-section. And that means that it fails there more and it's smaller, and it fails there even more and it's smaller, and that's where it snaps. Okay, is a positive feedback because of that. So, two different types of materials. This is pulled from Wikipedia, at least, where you get into a necking region. This area five here, is where all of a sudden I don't need as much force to pull the thing apart because cross-sectional area is smaller. And then it eventually fractures. You missed your cue. You were a little early on that one.
I was trying to do it when you said snaps.
Gotcha. So, well, there you go. So all of these things you'll learn more about as you move on. The key thing for our purposes, at least, is the initial approximation of linear behavior and the understanding of the terms stress, force per unit area, and strain, proportional change in the object due to that stress, and the linear relationship between them, that coefficient, that slope, is called a modulus, and it has units of pressure. So far, so good? You can trust me. I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. So lots of things can... It naively, you know, you might think, oh, everything is under compression or under tension. Boy, gosh, are we under tension. So a beam hanging from supports is a classic example of an object that's under both, right? It's under compression at the top because pieces of the beam are getting pushed together. And it's under tension at the bottom because pieces of the beam are being pulled apart. So you've got to build things that have beams. You can't support everything everywhere. Something's going to sag somewhere. You're building a bridge, you're building a floor, you're building something horizontal under the force of gravity. So what are classic materials? What are standard engineering materials, period? Name a good engineering material.
Steel,
wood, okay. So what is the one of the ones I was thinking of, first of all? Steel. Steel is great. It's really, really heavy, and it's hard to get to, and you have to mine it. But steel, at least, is pretty strong uniformly in all dimensions, under compression and under tension. Wood. How? Wood comes from trees. Wood evolved to be better under what? Tension or compression?
Compression,
right? I mean, trees have to support their weight under compression of gravity, and they grow vertically. Now, trees also, are they good or are they not so good under shear? Because they grow tall. Well, we can cut them down, but that's a lot of force, right? So trees also have to deal with wind. And what they do is they sway and they weave, but they generally don't fall over because of that shear stress, particularly that shear stress applied at the bottom. Reminds me, I still have a homework problem to do about the tree falling. I'll get to that one later on.
Yeah.
So fibers, all of those fibers that grow along the grain of the tree, they're very good under shear stresses transverse to them. Right? That's exactly why you take a board. You don't make a board that has all of the fibers running perpendicular to the board, because you try and shear it and you're shearing along the fibers. What you want is a board that is cut so that all of the fibers run the length of the board. You want to make the board along the length of the tree, because then those fibers produce a great deal of support, a great deal of structural integrity against shear as well. Plus, it looks prettier as a woodworker. Anyway, what about concrete? Is concrete better under compression or tension? Compression, okay. And I think all of you guys are engineers, and so you know that. Concrete actually sucks against tension, okay? If you take a concrete beam without rebar in it, without some sort of support, and do this with it, what'll happen is it'll break and it'll fracture at the bottom. And it'll open up and it'll crumble. What you do is you put rebar in it precisely to add essentially, you know, fake grain. You produce extra support along the dimension that gives it support under shear and gives it support under tension. So that's why you put rebar in reinforced concrete, and that's why it was such a huge deal. I mean, even they knew about concrete for hundreds of years. Still couldn't build a building taller than 6 or 7 stories, even though it's tremendously great under compression, until they had rebar. Okay? That was a great insight. So there is one other term, and this is a bridge concept between the two, between the ideas of shear and strain, stress, and that is, as a bulk object, there's a concept called compressibility, which is just 1 over the bulk modulus. That's really how it's defined. You can factor things around here, and you can actually end up with something that looks like a derivative of volume with respect to pressure. You mechies, you physics people, all of you will end up using a dV, dP at some point in your lives, how the volume responds to pressure. The compressibility is just defined as 1 over the bulk modulus. And remember, a larger modulus meant more response to the force, right? So a larger modulus meant a larger force was required to deform the object, because many things have very, very large moduli, right? 10 to the 11th, 10 to the 10th. So here, a larger compressibility means a smaller force is required for deformation. So if something is very compressible, hey, high compressibility means I can pack it down, right? And just like a lot of the solids, this is a table pulled out of the book of some example liquids. And it is interesting to see that, you know, there's a range of over, you know, a factor of 30 between mercury and ethyl alcohol. Mercury is 3.7, 10 to the minus 11. Ethyl alcohol goes up to 110. Ethyl alcohol, if you put it under pressure, you can actually pack it in. You can actually increase its density. You can compress it. But other things, you know, water is less so. Mercury is even less so. Mercury really doesn't like to be compressed. And for the most part, though, you see all of these things. I mean, these things are 10 to the 10th, 10 to the 11th-ish type of things, right? They don't, even most liquids are not compressible. Most gases are. As a matter of fact, that's how you make liquid nitrogen. You take air and you just pack it in. And if you keep on packing it in, PV equals NRT in thermodynamics helps you win to the point where you actually reduce the temperature and get liquid nitrogen. Yeah. We won't get into thermodynamics in this course, but it's fun. Okay. But liquids are not truly incompressible, but they're pretty close. Has anybody, like me, who has done a belly flop into a swimming pool can attest, boy, that water does not get out of the way very quickly. And it's pretty close to, if you take a leap off the Golden Gate Bridge, you are hitting concrete when you hit the water. Point your toes. And even then, good luck. Okay, hydraulics work because of this. Pneumatics work a little bit differently. Pneumatics work because gases are compressible and they provide some nice shock absorber. They transfer forces more slowly. Hydraulics, on the other hand, are the things that you use for fine control. If you push a piston to make a force occur in another place, using hydraulics, you can be pretty sure that as you adjust that piston finely, that fluid is not going to compress very much, and it's going to transfer your forces exactly the way you want it to. We'll get into an example in a second, an extension, kind of a logical extension, of why hydraulics can act as levers and how they can. So here's kind of a classic compressibility or a classic bulk modulus example for water. It's a standard example. So let's say I take a cubic meter of water and I bring it down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, right? Huge pressures. Right? Anybody is squished into an oil droplet down in the bottom of the ocean down there. It's literally, thousands of atmospheres of pressure? You'd think that it would really compress something if it's compressible. Certainly it'll compress your little brother. He'll fit into something a lot smaller than that box when you're done with him. So take these numbers and go down 10.9 kilometers to that pressure. And what is the relative change in volume of that cubic meter of water? Bulk modulus is just defined as that change in pressure, that's thrust, that difference in stress between atmospheric pressure and down there. Can look up the bulk modulus of water. Well, it's just 1 over this compressibility. So I took this compressibility and I took 1 over it. And you notice that the compressibility of water, right, or the bulk modulus of water, 2×10⁹, bulk modulus of water compared to the bulk modulus of something like steel. Steel is 100 times less compressible than water. Okay. Makes me feel better at least. That must mean water is pretty compressible, right? If I take it down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, it's really going to change a lot. Well, let's take it down there. 1 atmosphere of pressure is a little over 10⁵ pascals, if you type it into Google. And then go through that calculation with the difference in pressure between atmospheric pressure and the bottom of the Marianas Trench is pretty much that, okay? Bottom of the Marianas Trench is over 1,000 atmospheres of pressure. And the relative change in volume is this change in pressure divided by that bulk modulus. Ends up being 5%. So taking a liter, taking a volume of water and putting enough pressure on it that you're at the bottom of the ocean only compresses at 5%. Doesn't feel like much. No wonder we all just assume your everyday pressures are nowhere near that. Not going to, you know, volume is going to change maybe a percent, not even that. Well, ice making is different. Water is amazing and water is special for a lot of reasons beyond this course. But 5%, let's just say water is incompressible. Let's just use that as a good approximation. Mercury is even more so. Okay? So that's a lead-in, right? That's taking moduli, that's taking stress, strain, compressibility concepts, and it leads naturally into, oh, okay, well, if fluids are mostly incompressible, what can we do to talk about incompressible fluids? How can we understand fluid mechanics? In the next couple days, we'll cover that, and then we'll do some review on Wednesday, too. Because I think, oh, my God, I might actually run a little short today. So for these purposes, we're not going to do Pivnert. We're not going to do ideal gas law. We're not going to do compressible things. That's for the chemists. We're going to do incompressible fluids. Because incompressible fluids are the root of hydraulics, are the root of a lot of engineering, and the root of some cool physics that doesn't require us to actually get into thermodynamics. When you do ideal gas law, when you do gases, you kind of gotta do thermodynamics. And we'd do that if we had time. So let's just take a good liquid, a good fluid, water, mercury, ethyl alcohol, and talk about fluids that don't change volume under pressure. Let's just assume that it's incompressible. It's a good approximation. Good enough for government work, good enough for engineers and physicists. So if we got kind of a, if it doesn't compress, that means that the density of the fluid isn't changing that much, right? It's going to keep the same volume for the same amount of stuff, because I can't pack more stuff into that volume. So then we have another material property, which is density, and everybody knows kind of what density is. You've all been exposed to it. But density is most relevant in this concept because it is now a material property. It is now approximately, for these types of fluids, constant. It's not constant for gases, not constant for compressible liquids, which get much harder. And for gases and compressible liquids, good Lord, density can vary a lot. But for now, let's say it's roughly constant. Yeah.
Which liquids are compressible of our terms?
Not that many. I started looking actually for an example of a compressible liquid. There are some, I mean, if you put oxygen under very, very high pressure, it's pretty compressible. But you have almost any liquid, traditional liquid at least, to really increase its density, you really got to put it under a lot of pressure. And once it liquefies, the higher pressures you get to, at some point you start hitting a thermodynamic triple point where the thing starts turning into a solid rather than a liquid too. Right? So it's there's oddly enough some things. So a little aside, oh God, because I have time. I said water was special. Water is special because it is one of the few liquids, in fact, I think the only liquid, where the solid density is less than the liquid density, right? As it freezes, it expands. And the classic example of why, of the rubber band example, where you say, oh, yeah, 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 okay, that's fine. There are two standard examples, right? Put ice cubes in your freezer, and sure enough, the ice cubes come out bigger than the water that went in. But the standard example is ice skates. Ice skates would not work unless water had this property. And that property is, under extra pressure, You transform, you melt that ice and change it back to water. And so when you skate around on ice skates on a good edge, what you're really doing is melting the ice directly underneath your skates and creating a water, small, microscopic water layer between you and the ice, and that's why you can slide. Ice by itself is not slippery. Ice by itself is actually very, very sticky. Take two pieces of ice and stick them together and try and rub them against each other without the water. When things are cold enough that the water layer doesn't form, and they tend to stick. It's only the water layer built up from the pressure that transforms and melts the water back into ice. And when you put it under pressure, why does it melt? It's because when it freezes, it gets bigger. So when it melts, it gets smaller. So when you push it together and try and put it under stress, it melts. As opposed to most other solids that if you put it under stress like that, they won't melt. So that was a complete aside. I have to go back to my stick. So for gases and compressible liquids, you know, density can change quite a lot. For our purposes, we're talking about, forget about that, uniform horse, you know, spherical horse uniform density. We're talking about constant density fluids. And pressure, a fluid is made up of lots and lots of atoms. Believe it or not, it was just a little over 100 years ago that people really believed in the existence of atoms. It wasn't that long ago. The grandparents, great-grandparents' generation didn't think that these atoms were real things. And the thing that demonstrated it was, in fact, all of pressure and statistical mechanics and the mathematical understanding of why all this stuff I'm about to talk about works. So a fluid exerts a force, and on average that force is perpendicular to its sides, right? Just like your force compressing something, it pushes back. Newton's third law, equal and opposite reaction. Why does it push back? Because of all kinds of molecules, you know, bouncing against you. For a solid, it's a different reason, really. But you've got a pressure exerted by a fluid, a force per unit area. Force per unit area is just like our stresses were before. And that pressure, you can argue from an average way, is going to be pretty constant over the area of a small fluid. Right? A big fluid, it's going to be bigger at the bottom, smaller at the top, because down there you have to support more of the liquid. That's fine, but over a small piece of area, at least a small volume, the pressure is going to be pretty constant. And the pressure in a fluid column will vary depending on where you are in the fluid column, as we'll see in a second. So this pressure, you see this pressure is always perpendicular to the area. So we know its direction. It's not like pressure goes that way or pressure goes that way. Whenever you talk about a pressure, it goes against the surface. And so pressure is a scalar, right? Pressure itself does not have a direction. If you open up a spigot and the water squirts that way, you can kind of do some calculations by figuring out the forces that push in that direction from the pressure. But you don't talk about the pressure of a container or pressure in a fluid as a vector. It just doesn't. The reason you get the direction there is not the pressure. The reason you get the direction there is because of the spigot that you're opening up. So I've got density. Density is defined as mass per volume, mass per unit volume. It's a material property. So now I can start talking about a bulk treatment of an object, just like I did bulk moduli and bulk treatments of how objects change under pressure and forces. Let's talk about, I put some fluid in a tank. My swimming pool, a big, you know, my soda, whatever it is, it's a column of fluid. And it's, let's take some little section of it that's got a cross-sectional area, and let's, I really hate that they use height. I wish they would use depth, because height always to me implies something above, you know, gravity stuff. Okay, it's fine. I'm using the same notation as they are in the book, and I apologize. So I've got this column of fluid, and I want to figure out what's the pressure anywhere within the fluid. And this height could just be how deep I am into the fluid. This thing could go on beyond the bottom of the page, for all I know. So what's the force at the bottom of this fluid? Well, it has to support, right, that pressure down and the pressure up from the base of this column has to support the weight of this column. So the force is the mass of that column times g, right? That equals gravity is a force tab. And what's the mass of that thing? Well, it's the density times the volume. And the volume of a cylinder is the height times the cross-sectional area. The volume of any parallel pipette or whatever would be the same thing. So I've got the density times the height times the area times gravity is the total force applied to the bottom. And the pressure is just that force divided by the area. The density times the height times gravity. That's it. That is the pressure anywhere within a column of a fluid. Whether it's mercury, whether it's water, you just stick in the density of whatever fluid it is, stick in how deep you are for H from the top. Remember to add in at the top, yes, the atmosphere is pushing on that thing, so at the top there is an atmospheric pressure, one atmosphere of pressure probably pushing on the top as well. We'll get into an example or two of why that's not the case. So you also have to worry, right? In atmosphere, there's an additional pressure on top, which adds an additional force on the bottom. So the total force on the bottom is this pressure plus the weight of the column. And you end up with the pressure at the bottom, of course, is just pressure at the top plus rho gh. So this is, it may feel obvious, okay, but for an incompressible, I assume that this fluid was incompressible because I could figure out the mass of this column as the volume times the density. If this thing was denser at the bottom and less dense at the top, can't do that. The density isn't constant over the entire volume. So this formula, the way it was derived, intrinsically assumes that the fluid was incompressible, that had a constant density throughout. They're pretty close to a constant density throughout. But other than that, it feels comfortable. Feels kind of like, gosh, remember potential energy? Remember what potential energy, you know, was for something lifted against gravity? It was mgh. Well, this is mgh divided by the volume. This is rho gh. It feels like there's a connection. If you move the fluid around and use mgh to figure out energy stuff, you'll come up with the connection. Okay? So it's 10 o'clock. Let's take a break. I'll work through some examples and stuff like that. Come back at 10 after, and we'll work through a few things. No, wet my whistle. Catch my breath.
and you broke all my beautiful.
Hey, what's up?
So the thing about rubbing ice together, I was wondering, like, why if you like in the we watched, like, I think it was called A Christmas Story or something, where little kids, like, yeah, on the bowl, why didn't the ice on the bowl just melt?
So if the cold is big enough, then it cools down the layer on this tiny fast and it's kind of melt the ice. Right? So the that goes into thermodynamics a bit. The heat capacity of the pole is very the pole is very conductive because it's metal. And so it tends to want to heat up kind of uniformly. This tiny is a tiny little thing where you only have one little one spot to try and cool up the big pole. So what's gonna happen is the temperature's not gonna raise very much on the pole. Right? And it's going to lower on this tongue and give this nice ice layer sticking his tongue to the pole. The proper way to get out of that, by the way, is drool profusely. If you ever get in that situation, because the fluid of your saliva, the water of your saliva, has a much larger heat capacity than your tissue does. It can carry a lot of body heat and form a layer that can warm up faster than the pole can cool it down. And you can eventually melt the ice by just trying to drool all over your tongue. So, you know, pro tip.
All right.
Not like I've never done that or anything. So, yes, I've done it. And I figured that at least that was my escape at the time rather than just trying to pull my tongue off, which is a rather painful proposition. Yes, and what can I do for you?
I have a question about the homework. Do we have to have for all the homework? Like, that will be done throughout the semester?
You should. You should have it for certainly most of them.
Okay. I've been forgetting to keep it. So I might have to go back.
So have you kept any notes on how you did the problems at the time?
I still have
scratch sheets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. There's assemble those. You know, if you want to revisit them in a way that at least they're organized enough that you can find your work for a particular problem, because that's the entire point. How it'd be useful to a future you where you're like, how did I do a problem on the rotational kinematics instead of, you know, looking at I'll figure it out. So that's the ultimate arbiter of what we're looking for. And it's really a, you know, thumbs up, thumbs middle. It's really a threefold.
I mean, how was it in summer
I'm on Vancouver time. What's your excuse? It's getting dark and cold, and winter is coming.
I don't know.
I know, it's shocking.
Where did everybody go? Oh no! Okay. So those of you that are still here, remind me to put some of this material on the exam. I love that evil grin. Since fluids are incompressible and since pressure only doesn't depend on cross section anymore, right? The cross section folded out of this. So I don't care whether the column is an inch wide or a mile wide. If I go down a certain distance, the area folds out. So as in this picture, right, this is a little demo showing that this liquid assumes the same height everywhere, regardless of the shape or the size of the fluid column above it. Pressure's the same. Even though there's more fluid in some cases than others, right, pressure's force per unit area. So they all level out.
In the case of particularly the third column you have pictured there, why is the pressure unchanged compared to the straight column when some parts of the column are not under any more water?
Because the water, as we'll see in a second with hydraulics, the water transmits the pressure through the curves. Okay, so the pressure is connected through the liquid, and so it doesn't particularly matter that it's curved or straight.
That's a very
19th century thing to say. Yeah, it is in some sense. I mean, a lot of this formalism was developed back then. So a classic example. Right, you've got, let's say I want to measure the pressure of the atmosphere upon me. Well, what can I do? I can reverse this picture, right? Instead of having atmospheric pressure on here and then a higher pressure down below, what I can do is I can put the open spot on the bottom, and on the top I can cap this off and try and suck all the air out and make a perfect vacuum, or as close to a vacuum as I could make, you know, given the times that were involved. So this is the advent of the barometer. A barometer measures atmospheric pressure. Barometer, atmospheric pressure. So what they did is they played with mercury. Don't try this at home, kids. Mercury is bad. Exactly. So, and all the hatters, too. Take a tube, like a test tube, and cleverly suck out all the air and then seal the end really, really quick and see how high this column is. So what you've got is you've got atmospheric pressure pushing on the bottom and nothing pushing on the top of this column. And so the difference between this and this level where the atmospheric pressure exists, you know that this is also the level of pressure of the mercury in this column at this point. Right? So that means that height has to follow my little magic formula, rho gh for pressure, because there's no pressure on the top of the mercury. So atmospheric pressure, we just looked up before. Google 1 ATM in PA gives you 1.01 times 10 to the fifth pascals. Okay. The density of mercury in kilogram per meter cubed. Click. And you end up getting a formula. And now the pressure here is the density of mercury times G, which you know, times the height of the column, I want to figure out the height of the column, so that's the P over G rho. Plug in those numbers, and I end up getting 760 millimeters.
758.
This is at sea level somewhere in the U.S.-ish. 760 is kind of the number I know off the top of my head. It's just that there's another unit, I think, Tor? Tor is millimeters mercury? Something like that? So, right, yeah, I mean, the units of pressure get very, very confusing if you let them get away from you. But in any event, you can build something if you know a little bit of glass blowing and have about, you know, a few hundred grams of mercury. You can build something that actually measures atmospheric pressure wherever you are. And this, then you can mark your test tube here up and down, and you can measure whether it's lower or higher. Higher pressure, the column will be higher because it will push, have to support more mercury. Lower atmospheric pressure, if you go all the way down the vacuum, then both of these will be equal, right? Why mercury? Yeah. Because the units actually end up working out, right? A pascal is newton per meter squared, and newton is a kilogram meter per second squared. So that cancels out there, so I have kilograms per meter squared up here and a kilogram per meter cubed down here. So I end up getting units of meters, and when I do all the math, it's 0.758 meters. And everybody always wrote down millimeters because it's a natural unit to express this in. 760 millimeters was the when you get changes in barometric pressure typically in normal weather, this thing ranges from somewhere around, gosh, 740 to 780. Expressing in centimeters is way too coarse a scale. And expressing it in meters is way too coarse a scale. Yeah?
About that, are you going to take the pressure constant, are you going to expect us to change it from, like,
am I going to give you all a constant like this? I'll give you it, right? And I don't want you to spend your time in an exam having to Google 1 ATM MKPA, right? The point of an exam is not to test your Google food. But on the other hand, pro tips, right? In your future career, knowing that Google does units and does calculations with units and does trivial unit conversions is a really, really convenient thing to have. And that's one of the meta skills I want you to take away. But no, I won't make you look it up in the middle of the exam. And if you feel like, oh gosh, I have to look this up, then tell me and I'll look it up for you and I'll put it on the board. Because that means that I forgot to put it down and I don't, and you're doing all of your classmates a favor. One reason I don't grade quote unquote on a curve is because if you grade on a curve, if your buddy suffers, you do better in a relative sense. Grading on a curve encourages sometimes even unethical behaviors or unethical competition in a class. I want a cooperative class. You're all in this together. You all should be learning together. You all are buddies and pals. You're not mortal enemies, and this person's A does not mean you're B+. Okay?
Compressibility of everything we've talked about so far, mm-hmm. and therefore the highest accuracy.
And it's also really, really dense. So here's another example. I didn't have a ton of mercury sitting around. Let's try this experiment again with water instead. So this is really, really dirty water. Shh, don't tell anybody, it's the same picture. Right, and it's a water column. And now the density of water, you see, is almost, you know, 10, is over 10 times lower than mercury, right? Mercury is 10 to the 1.3 × 10⁴ kilograms per meter cubed. Water is defined, actually, pure water is defined as 1 kilogram per cubic meter. So, or a gram per cubic centimeter. So what's the height of a column of water if I do this? And I work through all the math. Okay, I do the same exact thing, just with a different density. And I end up having to get a water column that's 10 meters high. So that's why you didn't build your barometers out of water back in the old days. That's because nobody was going to blow a glass tube 30 feet long and try and pin out, you know, a vacuum at the top of it and suck up a column of water. Okay, that was just not going to work so well. And if the vacuum is not perfect in here, okay, there's an offset that occurs between your 768 and whatever it is, but you can still measure relative changes pretty accurately. So glass blowing is like woodworking. It's one of those, it's like farriers, people who make, you know, blacksmithing and horseshoes. It's one of those lost skills, lost arts that by the time your kids are around, maybe very few people will know how to do it. But glass blowing is also amazing. So here is why hydraulics work. Not pneumatics, hydraulics. And that is that pressure, right? Pressure is force per unit area. Well, now if I enclose a volume and I have two things that can move and push that incompressible fluid around, what I have is I have force per unit area being the same on both. Same volume, same fluid, same pressure. Pressure is force per unit area. So there's a little law called Pascal's law, and that pressure force per unit area on one thing and on the other thing is the same. Oh, but I can change the areas. And if I make one area small and one area big, then I can make the corresponding forces small and big as well. In my mind, this is just like a lever. It's exactly like a lever, except it's a lever that acts through liquid. It's exactly why hydraulics work. The other amazing thing is once you have containers that are flexible, you can now build big rig machinery, right? Big, huge things that exert huge forces over large lever arms with long tubes full of oil and have hydraulics power them. So pistons, right? These are pistons reacting to pressure. And as I push over a small area, over a longer distance, I move a volume that then transfers that force and that work that I do over a smaller distance, but a larger area and a larger volume, right? Yeah.
Why use oil?
Because oil is really incompressible, because it is also a lot slipperier. So it also provides lubrication as well. There are hydraulic systems that work with water too, but at least large machinery uses oil. It's a good question about exactly why, but certainly they do. So you'll see some homework problems that apply this concept, apply Pascal's law. Because this is engineering, man, right? Give me not just a lever large enough and a fulcrum that I can move the earth. Now it's not a fulcrum. The entire pressure is distributed among the container of that fluid. So I don't need a single point to lever with. Now I can distribute it through a hose, through something that is designed to withstand the shear stresses of the extra pressures against the surface. And then what I can do is I can really transfer the force through an incompressible fluid from a small piston to a large device and then lift up a car or an elephant or whatever you want. And the same goes as well here, right? A small movement here moves a lot of the fluid, and a small set of this force will move this piston quite far, because what's really being conserved, you might say, is the volume of stuff that's displaced. I move through a certain distance here, and this volume of the fluid is displaced. It's an incompressible fluid, man. It's got to go one place, and it has to go over here. And so this volume has to be the same as well. In pneumatics, with a compressible fluid, there is a complicated relationship of the changing pressure and the changing density of the gas that's in there, and the time it takes for that compression to relay through the system, and all sorts of stuff like that. Much harder. Incompressible fluids, Pascal's law, it's just very simply this relationship. So far, so good? You'll see homework on this later on tonight. And the last thing I want to cover in this class today is getting into Archimedes' principle. Because this is the eureka moment of over two millennia ago. Right? Some rich white guy sitting in his tub, leaping out and going, I had an aha moment. One of the original aha moments, supposedly. There's a naked Greek guy running down the street. So the insight here is that you take your fluid column again. And this is an incompressible fluid. Let's say it's water for now. Whatever the fluid is, it's incompressible. And let me let it settle down so that everything is still. If everything is still, any section, any portion of that fluid is not moving. It's in equilibrium. And as you know, the conditions for equilibrium are the sum of all the forces has to be equal to zero in all dimensions. The forces on this thing, there are two, kind of generally two forces. One is the force of gravity, and one is the force of pressure on that area, the surface area of that thing. My gosh. Aha! Run through the streets. Okay? The net force on this object has to counter gravity. The net force of any shape within the fluid. It doesn't have to be the fluid. Anything that I put in that fluid is going to experience those same pressures. And therefore, those same forces, those forces would be the forces that supported the fluid if it were there in equilibrium. So therefore, anything I submerge into a liquid is supported, is countered. Gravity counters it by the force, the weight of the water that object displaces. Because if the water were there, it wouldn't be moving. So if I'm there, okay, I might still move because I might be heavier or lighter than the water that I displaced. But by gosh, there is a force called buoyancy, which is the net of all the pressure acting on that object. And the net of all the pressure acting on that object counters gravity. And so there is a mystery force, buoyancy, that always points up, right? It always effectively is the weight of the displaced fluid pointing against gravity. That is a net extra force. So a body immersed in water seems to weigh less than it does when it's in air. Actually, you weigh a little bit less than you would in a vacuum on the surface of the planet, because you are displacing air. And you are therefore a little bit lighter by the volume of air you displace. Just how it works. So So if I put a body that's less dense in that fluid, my gosh, it supports the object so much that the object rises to the surface. It's like gravity doesn't exist and it floats on the top of the water until the volume that it displaces, the volume of that liquid it displaces, has the same mass as the total object. And then the object is in equilibrium again. So this is known as Archimedes' principle. It's, you're going to see some homework on it because it may seem naively easy, but you got to be careful about a couple of special cases, right? There's a special case where I'm floating, and then it's only the volume that that's submerged that you displace, the amount of wire that you displace that you use as an extra force of buoyancy. If the object is completely submerged, then its entire volume is what is used to calculate the mass of the corresponding fluid and the corresponding buoyancy force. So I'll give you some homework on that. I'll give you some homework on Pascal's law. I'll give you some homework on stress and strain, and that'll get us ready for exam time. Any questions so far? We're going to go over Venturi and over airfoils and stuff like that, a little bit of surface tension and continuity equation on Wednesday. Not much of that will be on the homework, maybe a bit. So go, fly, be free. I will work on the homework as well. And if you have any questions on it, email me.